Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foley. He is Nick Osello, and this is a little bit of a weird one because Nick, on Sunday night, I spoke to a half dozen Division I coaches who had just either had their teams selected for, or in one coach's case, very notably not selected for the NCAA tournament, and we are talking on Tuesday afternoon. We're going to go over a lot of different stuff, including the first round of the NCAA tournament, the weekend that was, because it was an absolutely insane conference championship weekend, and as promised last week, we got some superlatives to go through. So take it away, Nicky O.
This is when you sit down at the bar and you say, I don't know what I want to order. Ooh, let's get a sampler platter. That's what this episode is. It's the sampler platter, game recap, conference recaps, predictions, bracketology. Everything that you tune in to this lovely podcast to listen to, you're going to get just a little taste of. Ooh, maybe a chicken wing, maybe a Southwest egg roll at Chili's, maybe even some loaded tots. Who knows? And to start things off, I mean, hold on.
Before we start things off, mozzarella stick or onion ring? You got one onion of ring. Each left on the platter.
Onion ring, not even close. Mozzarella sticks are really overrated, and there are better ways to get cheese in there. I'd rather have a queso dip than mozzarella sticks. What about you?
Same, and I agree with you, but I would actually find a middle ground between your mozz point, which is, the stick is probably the worst shape that it can come in. Superior shapes for deep fried cheese include balls and little patties. I don't know if you've ever had like a triangle of like fried cheese, very big in Wisconsin, etc. All superior. I'm not going to get down on sticks. I'm just saying structural integrity, not strong. Dippability, weak. Stretch, great stretch on the stick, but they all pale in comparison to the onion ring. So take it away.
Yeah, and the versatility, I mean, talk about a one-dimensional threat. You get the stretch, and then you get overloaded on salt, and then similar to nachos, but if you don't eat mozzarella sticks immediately and quickly, that last cold mozzarella breaded cheese stick is disgusting. Final point on food before we go, I've had a patty, like a mozzarella thinned out patty that was deep fried and part of a burger. So it was like the cheese stretch, and it was unbelievable. So I agree that the fact that sticks is the way that cheese has been fried and presented as an appetizer is a bit of a tragedy.
So do mozzarella sticks cause Sunday scaries? I don't think scientists know that yet. It might be a direct cause and effect relationship.
No, and scientists are all focusing on the wrong thing. They're focusing on diseases and COVID and whatever else they focus on. They need to be talking more about mozzarella sticks. So, all right, now we'll get into it.
We need to be talking more about college lacrosse.
Yes and no. Yeah, let us know where our appetizer discussion falls on things that are important that happened in your week. With that being said, how do you even attack this weekend? There are 500 different things to talk about, but we're just going to go by tournaments, I guess. And starting with my favorite, the biggest storyline of the weekend, in my opinion, and that's Michigan winning the Big Ten title. They do it in not just a victory over Maryland, not just their second victory over Maryland, but the most dominant performance that a team has had against Maryland in decades. This was flat out domination. And of the predictions that we had, we kind of were talking about how Michigan was a dangerous team. I truly did not know that they were this dangerous. Mike Boehm has separated himself as a truly elite player, as opposed to a guy who I was just thinking he could have a good game, he could have a bad game. This kid's a stud. Michigan's doing it all. And this game set the tone for Michigan to be a much scarier opponent. A big theme of what we're going to be talking about kind of through the course of this episode is the mind games and the mental state of how you're approaching your opponent. If I'm getting ready to play Michigan, that game doesn't do anything for my level of confidence. And the last thing that they put on tape was a dominant performance against what was arguably, a top four, certainly. And I think some people would even say top three team in the nation in Maryland. So Big Ten tournament, starting with Michigan before we discuss anything else. Terry, go blue.
It was incredible. I mean, especially because they handled success so well. I was at Thursday, so I saw both Michigan's win over Penn State and Maryland's win over Hopkins in person. And I can't say I was stunned by how well Michigan played against Penn State, because they had felt like they had gotten the regular season game. Oh, they had let it slip through their fingertips. And so I think it was a factor for both Penn State and Hopkins. They were playing teams that they had already beaten, and human nature crept in. They didn't need to win in order to get into the NCAA tournament, and they already felt like they were better. And I think that this is the most underrated aspect of why the team that loses the first meeting has the advantage in the matchup, or in the rematch, excuse me. It's because they have incentive to change what they do, and the team that won has incentives to stick with what they do. And so as a result, it's just one team is way easier to scout and prepare for than the other. And ultimately, you roll that all the way up into the fact that Penn State-Michigan was even through the first half, and they changed goalies, and once they started making saves, they went from being a team that could win faceoffs, and as long as their offense was getting the ball with some measure of consistency, at the very least keep pace with their opponent, to a team that did what Michigan did against Maryland 48 hours later, which was dominate at both ends of the field. And they didn't dominate the faceoff X. They went 12 for 21, and Luke Wehrman got off to an excellent start. But at the same time, once the game started to level out a little bit, it felt like Michigan was going to be able to score most trips down. And after Eric Spanos was this incredible inverting dodging threat, Michigan figured out at least some measure of how to handle him. It wasn't clear where Maryland's goals were going to come from. And this was, you know, one of the more lopsided losses you mentioned in decades. It is the most lopsided loss of the John Tillman era, and it was the first time they had lost by 9 goals since 2006, I believe. So, you know, I would be terrified if I was an Army fan, because when you exhibit that measure of consistency for more than a decade, the likelihood that you put in two bad performances in back-to-back weeks, especially when you're coming home with so much on the line in the first round of the NCAA tournament, remains very slim. All that being said, there are some legitimate questions to ask about Maryland's ability to score goals. But I also think you have to give a lot of credit to Jim Rogalski, Kevin Connery, and the defensive personnel for the Michigan Wolverines. When I was watching that game, especially after Hunter Taylor came in, and it was clear that there was confidence in front of him in, you know, specifically the four-man long pull unit, that they were going to get stops if they were pushing their Dodgers to the positions on the field that they wanted them to be pushed to. I felt like the way they played on the string was just so impressive. And so Jack Whitney, the LSM Ryan Schreiber, Case Van Wees, and, you know, Andrew Darby is their number one, right? And his return from injury early in the season has corresponded with an uptick in success. But the other element of this is when you look at Michigan over the last two seasons, they have been improved in 2021 and 2022. But the difference is between this year and prior years, the depth at short stick defensive midfield. And I know that we don't talk about short stick D-middies on this podcast, so I won't. But number 21, number 99, number 6, these guys, I mean, just the number of guys that they can rely on is really impressive, really, really important. And I felt like the number 88, who kind of is not really even a short stick D-middie because he really only takes the wings of faceoffs and then scores a ton of goals off of that. So maybe we can say the name Emmett Houlihan. I don't know. He just brought like a really interesting wrinkle. He scored twice against Penn State. And the last thing is just got to mention Justin Brown. He is a legitimate pro lacrosse player who had not scored a goal as an offensive midfielder through the first 13 games of Michigan's season. And then I mentioned that Michigan made a goalie change at halftime. Early in the third quarter, down a goal, here comes Justin Brown dodging out of the box. He's a righty. He said that he had been practicing going to his left all week. He gets a step and he just hammers the top corner from about 13 yards on the run. Next possession, come right back down, last guy out of the box, splits to his right, goes down the righty alley, finds, you know, the easy throw ahead pass, hits a single to Mike Bame, who then skips it back up top. Boom, hammers a step down. Now Michigan's up one, comes back out the next possession, scores a goal. Now they're up two. And from that point on, the game was never really in doubt. So you can really tie almost every aspect of a storyline for a team playing well into what Michigan looked like over the course of those two games. And it's tough for me because I wrote last week about how peaking right now is not when you want to peak if you want to win an NCAA championship, because it is too hard to sustain this level of enthusiasm, focus, performance for 4 or 5 weeks. You want to peak the weekend of the quarterfinals because I think it is realistic to sustain that for 9 days. But at the same time, yes, Michigan probably isn't going to play as well as they did against Maryland and Penn State again this season. But if they play 80 to 85% as well, or is that good enough to beat Cornell? I think so. Especially with what we saw out of Cornell defensively when they gave up to 15 goals to Yale on Friday night, which we'll talk about. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely the high watermark in the history of Michigan varsity lacrosse. And then one thing that I can't fail to mention is the toughness and specifically the willingness to overcome adversity. Just a truly remarkable performance for the program and a lot to celebrate this week, no doubt.
That was the big point you made right there at the end that I took away from was, okay, so if you play your picture perfect game, you slap Maryland around. What does that mean about your confidence when you're only playing 80% of your best? Like, I feel like that just raised the bar so much for them that not only could Cornell be, loading up its britches and getting a little bit scared, but it gives Michigan all the confidence in the world of like, hey, even if we start off with a bad quarter or even if we have stretches of bad lacrosse, we don't have to put together a perfect game, because if they put together a perfect game and beat Maryland by one, different story than putting together a perfect game and beating them by infinity goals.
Nice.
So very, very scary. And anything else that you're taking away from the Big Ten tournament? It was kind of an interesting one. I didn't look too much into Michigan beating Penn State, and I didn't look too much into Maryland beating Hopkins. So were there any other takeaways from the Big Ten tournament?
I think Hopkins fans are a little concerned about their goalie play, but I have confidence and faith in Tim Marcial that he's going to show up in the moments that it's called upon. So aside from that, you know, it was a Hopkins team that just all in all didn't put in the performance that they had put in when they played Maryland 10 days prior. So, you know, again, I chalk it up to human nature. They had been a fourth quarter team. They had been on a long streak. They were due for a performance like this, and you can only be glad it didn't happen in the NCAA tournament because it didn't end their season.
Yep. So good. Honestly, hope Notre Dame gets the win against Utah. Hope Hopkins beats Bryant. And then I'd love to see a Notre Dame-Hopkins matchup. That's a rare one. One of the few major teams that I personally never played against and I feel like is rare to see come up on the schedule. So hoping for that and hoping for a shutout performance so we don't hear that stupid song. We will talk about that later. The other unbelievable tournament to me was the Ivy League. And this one was just very difficult to make sense of. So it started off with Princeton beating Penn by one, which effectively ended Penn's entire season. We'll talk about snubs in a little bit. And then Yale flat out dominating Cornell 22-15, which teed up Yale-Princeton. And so you would think, oh, Yale's playing good. They just beat Cornell. What's that score going to be? Princeton dominates 19-10. So really the only close game was Princeton-Penn. Yale slaps Cornell around and then subsequently gets spanked by Princeton. All three teams have secured a spot, with Princeton playing Penn State, Yale playing Georgetown, and Cornell playing Michigan, which we alluded to earlier is a now scarier than before this weekend matchup. So we'll start with what was the more shocking dominant performance, Princeton over Yale in the championship or Yale over Cornell in the semis?
Yale over Cornell in the semis. You know, we'd already seen Princeton dominate Yale. I didn't expect it to happen, but you can't chalk it up as big of a surprise, because essentially what Yale did was completely flip that regular season game. Now, again, you can kind of chalk this up to human nature. there was one team that knew they had to win in order to get in. Now, you can argue that Penn should have played like they knew that if they didn't win, they didn't control their own destiny. But at the same time, I don't think Penn expected Michigan to steal the Big Ten AQ and ultimately jump them in the NCAA tournament hierarchy. So, you know, disappointing result for the Quakers, no doubt. But it's crazy. It's going to be interesting to see how Cornell prepares for Michigan, because Gavin Adler is such a weapon, but he is very clearly best utilized against teams that rely heavily on one player. And I typically point to what Cornell has done against Jack Myers in their last three meetings as being an example for a lot. It illustrates a lot and it answers a lot of questions, because whenever you talk about Gavin Adler, people start from the standpoint of him being 5 feet, 8 inches tall. Well, Jack Myers is 6'4", and he can guard him as effectively as pretty much any defenseman has guarded him. And when he does, it has significant ripple effects on Ohio State's offense in general. Well, you translate that against a team that has two or three attackmen that can be equivalently dangerous in terms of starting offense or getting their own. And that's essentially what we saw. Cornell guarded Matt Brandau with Gavin Adler, and Yale basically put the ball in Chris Lyon's stick and said, go to work. And he did exactly that. And the broadcast talked a lot about whether or not they should change the matchup and what it meant that they didn't, and, you know, on and on and on. And it was a kind of meaningful takeaway when you think about the context of Michigan has Josh Sawada, Mike Baim, and Ryan Cohen dodging out of the midfield. So it's going to be interesting and important to see who Cornell tries to take out of the game with Adler, and then how Michigan responds, you know, if they essentially try to play a little bit of 5-on-5. Ultimately, these were two very compelling games. I think that even though the Yale-Cornell score was lopsided, it was still interesting. And then the Penn-Princeton game was very low scoring. I think it was 4-4 through the third quarter. And I compared it to a baseball game in the best way possible, because it felt like every goal was a run in an October baseball game, where it just ratcheted up the tension. And it felt like if you were the guy who was responsible for giving up that goal, yeah, how, like, your offseason was just going to be obsessed with that moment. Whereas if you were the guy that scored that goal, you were essentially going to go home and get a ticker tape parade. You were going to be the local hero. And ultimately, it opened up in the fourth quarter, as a lot of games like that do. But credit to Princeton for making the plays down the stretch that allowed them to extend their season, and then for coming out and putting in a dominating performance. Mike Gianfrancaro, who we've discussed how much fun his last name is to say, we have not discussed nearly as much how good of a goalie he is, and he is an excellent goalie. And he made 17 saves against Yale. And that wasn't necessarily the difference in the game, but it was a really, you know, kind of significant, compelling, and important season-defining moment for the Tigers. And, you know, they're a team that's battled a ton of injuries. It isn't the reason that they lost some of their early season games, but it makes it even more impressive that they've been able to put together this stretch down the backside of the season, because to do it without Sammy English, who you can make an argument was their most important player at the end of last season, he was their initiator offensively. He was the midfielder whose responsibility it was to draw slides. He didn't have that type of season this year before he got injured against Syracuse, and they figured out ways to make it work. You saw a bunch of different signs of life and sparks over the course of the game against Yale, and as a result, the Tigers head to Penn State. You know, we talked about how I don't know what they put on film against Michigan as a true representation of who they are as a team, because, again, human nature. Did they need it, and did they play like they didn't need it? But at the same time, they're going to have to figure out a way to guard Colter Mackesy, and they're going to have to figure out a way to win faceoffs, and they're going to have to figure out a way to get the ball past Gianfrancaro. So challenge at Jeff Tamburoni's feet, really compelling first-round matchup.
I love how out of this weekend there are macro cool interesting storylines and there are micro cool interesting storylines, and the micro being exactly like what you just called out: how is Cornell going to use Gavin Adler to shut down one of the three pillars of Michigan? You know, what is Yale's and one of the big ones that I'm kind of excited to see is I hand up, maybe it's a little bit of bias, but when Penn State kind of ran through the Ivies earlier this season, I wrote off a lot of just how good the Ivies are, particularly in their out-of-conference play, Penn State being the best representation of that. I am very, very curious to see how the Ivy League performs in this first round because there is not an Ivy-on-Ivy matchup, of course. So I don't know who the favorites to be or how much stock I should put in Cornell's good victories or Yale's win over Cornell or Princeton, because in my mind, it's just, oh, well, that's just the Ivy Leagues beating each other up and they're not very good this year. So none of those matchups and none of what they're putting on tape holds as much weight as a good out-of-conference performance where we can gauge a little bit more. How right am I in that mindset?
Yeah, I mean, there are only a handful of wins that you can point to that matter from this standpoint. You know, Yale's win over Villanova, which came the week after Villanova beat Penn State. I mean, that was in February, right? I was talking to you on the way home from Villanova, Penn State. It was our first podcast of the year, and it was Super Bowl Sunday. So seriously, how much weight can you actually put into that? You know, and there are a few others, but not many. And certainly not many that have the direct correlation here. So I think the question for me is less, how good is the Ivy League relative to other leagues? And it's more, how good are these Ivy League teams relative to how good they were in February and March? And if you want to argue they're a lot better, there are reasons why that holds water, but the results are going to be played, meaning that, you know, we're going to find out in 5 days how good the Ivy League teams actually are. Are they going to go, you know, 0-3, 1-2, 2-1, or 3-0? And where they fall on that spectrum is going to determine how much criticism they take, A, for getting the third team in this year. And you know it's going to stretch back to last year too. And people are going to say like, oh, well, the fact that they went 1-2 this year shows that they didn't deserve six teams last year. It's like, well, okay.
And they're absolutely right. If you think that, you are correct, and good on you. And then last question where we talk about the Ivy Leagues, who do you have? And I know you might say, oh, well, you know, we'll find out later. We're not here to have rational takes here. Who's the most dangerous representative of the Ivy League? And I'm not talking about who's going to be a banker and tank the economy and you know, obliterate our 401ks and raise the debt ceiling and buy all the swaths of housing and then, you know, we'll own nothing and be happy for it. All of that aside, who's the most dangerous lacrosse program coming out of the Ivies?
I'm going to go with Yale only because I like their matchup versus Georgetown better than I like Cornell's matchup versus Michigan. Actually, you know what? No, I take it back. I'm going to go with Princeton. I'm going to go with Princeton.
Yeah, well, that's a bummer because that's what I was going to do. Yeah, no, I...
I'm not going to go. I'm going to stick with Yale, and here's why. Because if you're going to do the small brain thing where you're going to go with who's hot, and I'm going to do the galaxy brain thing where I'm going to go with who's having a great week of practice because they just got their ass kicked. So Georgetown is having they're having a great week of practice where they're heading to the golf course and getting ice cream after instead of shooting, you know, staying around shooting and hoping the coach doesn't see them take an extra sip of Diet Coke at lunch because he's so pissed about how they played 4 days ago. Whereas, and that's what's happening in Happy Valley. It's what's happening in New Haven. Whereas it's all sunshine and rainbows in DC. And so the Bulldogs are going to catch an otherwise complacent Hoya team.
Yeah, and you know, first off, to call that small brain. Well, here's double down on you have the smaller brain. I'm not saying mine's big. They're overworked. They're tired. They just put a steamer dump of a show on in the Ivy League championship. And now they're being put on the end line. And Coach Shea's going, oh, I forgot that the game was tomorrow. Maybe I shouldn't have made them do the conditioning test on Friday afternoon. And how much do you owe me? It's like two cases of Coors Light at this point. I think I've been completely right and you've been completely wrong.
Yeah, we're going to have to raise that debt ceiling a little bit more in order for
yeah,
to cover.
Yeah, let's raise the Coors ceiling and throw on a little extra case because I think Yale's out in the first round just to disagree with you, and I think Princeton advances. So how you like me now? How you like those apples? So moving on, done talking about the Ivy League, even though, boy, could I talk about how they didn't deserve that third spot, how they didn't deserve it last year. We're not here to talk about that. Patriot League. Interesting halfway correct prediction from us last week to start off this conversation of Loyola turned out to be a very dangerous team, just missing that AQ bid, which would have thrown everything for a loop. But instead, hey, how you doing, Army? What are your takeaways from the Patriot League championship?
Did you see the Army bench celebrations after they scored goals down the stretch?
Unbelievable. Where they stretchered the guy off and just carried a butt. Incredible.
I mean, using their sticks as long guns and being in like a crouching, walking, shooting position. It's the type of thing that if any other program did, they would immediately be canceled. But because these guys actually are trained and are actually going to have to do that in the future, we all are just like, okay, it's hilarious. Also incredibly morbid and it's your future, so do you guys. It was such a mind job watching it. I was like, I don't know how to feel about this at all, but I'm really enjoying it.
I'll tell you one thing. When I was coaching at Air Force, this is their time to blow off steam. They wake up and they have to shovel shit from 5 a.m. until about 3:55, and then 4 o'clock hits, and then the game hits, and they are let off the leash. Because I was like, I remember the first time playing against Air Force, and Coach Corrigan gives us this whole spiel about respect the troops. These guys go through a bunch of stuff, like, you know, keep your mouth shut, work hard, respect them. And then on the very first face-off, I got called some very unsavory names, and my mother was brought into the conversation. And I'm like, what the hell is this? I thought you guys were supposed to be the nice down, the respectful line. Little did I know, this was their time to be let off the leash, say anything that they wanted, celebrate, get a little loose, and have fun with what's objectively the worst, least fun collegiate experience from a let off the leash line. So seeing all these Army guys do the crouching, going, that's a little weird and morbid. Have the time of your life, do whatever you want to do, and we shouldn't feel bad about it. We should be clapping and talking about it like we are now.
So I didn't really ever think Loyola had a shot down the stretch. The final was 10-8 Army, but it felt a lot more like the 10-5 first, you know, regular season matchup to me. Partly because the manner in which Loyola beat BU just felt like a college basketball game where it's like, all right, that was their shot. You know what I mean? Like, they don't have anything more in the tank. It just required too much energy, both in the individual game as well as in, like, kind of the longer term over the course of, you know, a three-day stretch, right? So, you know, they fall behind 8-1 to BU. And then, you know, it's roughly even. I think it was tied at 11-11, 12-12. And then they score to go up 13-12. And, you know, I talked to Ryan Poley in the wake of the game, and he was basically saying what I would expect, which is just, you know, it was kind of one of those surreal moments where, you know, we had the game in control. We felt like it had flowed the way that we needed it to flow in order to feel confident coming away with a win. And then all of a sudden we were in a dogfight, and then all of a sudden we were in the locker room and the game was over. And, you know, it came down to a Lewis Perfetto open step down that Luke Stout was there to save high to high. I mean, you know, it is your prototypical game tying, game winning, late game goal situation where, and I should be very clear, I'm talking about the Patriot League semifinals where Loyola beat BU, and BU had a chance to tie. Ball comes down, Loyola is in scramble mode in the sense that, you know, any opportunity to double and try to either clog up time, like by basically making a guy escape a double and that chews up 5 seconds or getting the ball on the ground or whatever, we're taking it. And they did it effectively. But the problem is when you do that, if you don't come up with a ground ball, there is going to be an open man on the backside, one pass away. And that was exactly the situation that they found themselves in. And that is a goal that gets scored so frequently. And the only reason it didn't is because of Luke Stout, a goalie who had 20 saves in certainly in the win over Maryland. I can't remember whether he had 20 against Hopkins. I don't think he did. I don't think the Blue Jays had the ball that much or got the ball in cage that frequently. But, you know, just an incredible showing out of him. And then, you know, he had a bad middle of the year and got injured, didn't play every game. You know, he didn't start every game. So, credit to Loyola for sticking with him, and credit to him for responding and playing well and putting his team in a position to play for an AQ on Sunday. But again, you know, they fell behind early. And even though they were able to claw their way back in, to me, it felt like they weren't going to have the energy in order to get those one or two stops that were going to be necessary down the stretch in order to prevent Army from winning the tournament and getting the AQ and going to the NCAA tournament for the third time. I believe the third time under Coach Joe Brescia, or Joe Alberici. Jesus Christ, Joe Brescia. Joe Alberici.
So quick question, bracketology related. Boston goes 10-4. Their losses, Vermont, Navy, Yale, and Loyola. I'm not defending their loss against Vermont, certainly not their loss against Loyola or Navy, you know, or Loyola for that matter. Bottom line, was there ever an argument in which Boston should have gotten the AQ going into the number one seed and or at large, apologies. Was there ever any room for two Patriot League teams this year?
No. So the way that it broke down at the end was there were six teams for two spots. Effectively, there were four teams for two spots, and the two teams that got those spots were Cornell and Yale. Yale was the last team in. Denver was the first team out. The two teams that were closest
classic
to contention.
Classic Ivy League, right? And you're that's the Ivy League
bias.
Well,
no, because hold on. Don't interrupt me.
One of the selection committee criteria is, are you an Ivy League team? It's in the Google Forms. I saw it. It was leaked on WikiLeaks.
Then why was Penn the second team out?
Well, because, again, they have to throw off the trail. We talked about this last year about how you're a sheep, and I'm sad
that was the only reason that Dartmouth didn't get in.
Yeah. That just to throw off, it's like when you're running away and you, like, you know, throw a... it's like the Scooby-Doo distraction where you throw a steak to the guard dogs. Don't fall for Penn not getting in. That's the steak. Beware of the booby trap that is Yale getting in. Again, I'll slow it down for you if I have to.
The third and fourth teams in consideration were Rutgers and Villanova, which would suggest that at best BU was five spots removed from getting in. Now, if Michigan and Princeton don't win the AQs, does that mean that BU's third? Well, I don't think so, because I think Michigan and Princeton were probably both ahead of them if they hadn't won the AQ. So, short answer, no. I mean, you know, Boston University just didn't have the metrics. You know, their worst loss was the Navy loss. I mean, Vermont ended up being probably like 28 in RPI, whereas I believe Navy was in the low 40s. So that was their worst loss, but they had three outside the top 20, which, you know, it's hard to withstand that. That's the reason Duke didn't get in off of the bubble last year. And then on top of that, you know, they didn't have significant quality wins. I think they had two top 20 wins, Bryant and Army. So, yeah, I mean, you know, good season and, but an inconsistent season. And I think, you know, they know that, and it's tough because they had an opportunity to win a game and go back to the NCAA tournament for the second time in 2 years. But they fell short, and, that was it. They were out on Friday.
Tough year for the Patriot League. Yeah. So you got to run the table. You got to perform a little bit better. And speaking of performing a little bit better, the ACC is just back on top. The top dogs, brothers in hatred against one another and enemies of the state that is the Ivy League and the selection tournament, Duke and Notre Dame, and as well as Virginia, the sole representative of the ACC in last year's tournament, secure the top three bids in what can only be described as blasphemous. Duke gets the number one seed while also having the worst loss of any three of those top three teams. So, Terry,
are you accounting for their 14-2 win over Merrimack on Sunday?
No, that was a fluke. Merrimack, honestly, that score doesn't represent. I believe it was tied going into the second minute of the game. So... And So that score doesn't represent what actually happened. And it was Long Island and Merrimack, I believe, had a lot of chicken parmigiana subs, maybe some slices and bagels as well. So you have to take that into
account. If you were to tell me that like half of Merrimack's roster isn't allowed inside the state of New York for prior violations of the law, all misdemeanors for sure, I wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't be surprised either, and that's part of the reason why I love them. And they might make an appearance in this, this superlatives we got. Who knows? But with that being said, Duke gets the number one seed, Virginia, and then Notre Dame. This is a pretty classic case of I really only cared if we were on the same side of the bracket before the Final Four. If we would have had to go through two versus just one to get there. So to be on the same side of the bracket as Virginia, certainly not ideal. Duke is the lone top spot, and the four seed was Maryland. So you have Virginia and Notre Dame on one side, Duke and Maryland on one side. I, quite frankly, don't give a shit. The playoffs are the playoffs. Anybody can beat anybody. The top three seeds, while certainly relevant for argument's sake, I actually really like Notre Dame's path. And as we talk more shifting from tournaments to obviously the ACC is so good, we don't need to have a tournament, and we're better than all you if you're listening. This just affected the bracketology, and we can kind of shift into not only easiest paths to the Final Four and championship, if you could even argue that there's an easy path, but most interesting matchups. And I would say that Notre Dame having Utah and then the winner of Hopkins-Bryant, while not discrediting those three, is about as ideal as a first two rounds you can get. And that might come back to bite me in the ass, but I'd rather see that than Virginia has to beat Richmond and then the winner of Georgetown-Yale, which is scary. Duke gets the winner of Delaware-Maryland and then faces the winner of, provided that they win, Cornell-Michigan. Delaware-Marist, and then they likely win that. Again, not going to discount either Delaware or Marist, but then they have the winner of Cornell-Michigan. So it comes down to me is what does that second matchup, that second round matchup look like? And I would argue that Virginia and Duke have a much harder path to the Final Four than Notre Dame.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. And the reason I say that has less to do with the quality of the quarterfinal opponent and more so that when I talk to coaches about how much they care about seeding, you know, they don't really talk about it in the context of the first round or the semifinals. They talk about it in the context of the quarterfinals. And I think that's a reflection of a lot of things. Chiefly, making it to the Final Four it's not the destination, and I'm not arguing that, but it is a significant threshold, right? If you lose in the semifinals, you only lose 2 days of your season. Obviously, everybody wants to win a championship, but the gap between losing in the quarterfinals versus losing in the semifinals from a heartbreak standpoint is significant. I always massive. Point to Brett Queener breaking the shaft over his leg when they lost to Cornell in overtime in 2007. And he and I have had many conversations about that moment. And, you know, he just cites the fact that he grew up dreaming of going to the Final Four. And he got literally as close as you possibly can. And then it got taken away. And I think that that resonates. I understand that. So point being, I think there is a very overt, unspoken, avoid the blue blood in the quarterfinal and you're better off scenario. And that's why people made such a big deal out of Virginia playing Maryland in the quarterfinals last year. You know, I didn't find it to be that offensive or troubling from a seeding standpoint. It was not that unjustifiable to put Virginia where you put them on the road at Brown and then funneling them into Maryland in the quarterfinals. If you want to play the results, you can look at the way that that game unfolded and ask questions as to whether or not it was a disproportionate, one-sided outcome relative to Maryland's other NCAA tournament games last season. I think you will find that it was not. So point being, you're not alone avoiding a blue blood. And what a blue blood is, right? Kind of a difficult thing to describe. Is Notre Dame a blue blood, for instance? Is Johns Hopkins a blue blood?
No.
Okay.
Any other brilliant questions about blue bloods?
You weren't going to see Duke or Virginia in the quarterfinals anyway. So, I guess you can be relieved that there wasn't some bizarre fluke and you could have gotten Maryland. Because if the seeding had gone, you know, Hopkins 4, Penn State 5, Maryland 6, it wouldn't have been egregious. It wouldn't have been the least defensible thing that they've done in the last 2 years. It would have been a surprise. But one of the things that points to how egregious it is not is the fact that from an opponent standpoint, that's essentially what they did. Because Bryant would be, if you seeded this like pretty purely, they would be playing the number four team. So in that respect, you know, the bracket kind of did work out that way. But all that does is just point to Notre Dame's benefit because, you know, they get an actual number six seed that was playing a nominal number 13 seed. And, you know, with the exception of the fact that maybe Hopkins won't be as tested and as a result will be fresher and, you know, more ready to go if they do end up taking on Notre Dame in the quarterfinals. Aside from that, you know, there really isn't much benefit. Downside.
I hate to say when you make a great point, but you lose in the Final Four. It's heartbreaking. Like, the worst two losses are the quarters in the national championship. And the buzz of the Final Four is kind of your first, not your first I made it moment, because there are the practices, there are the big games, there are things like that. But when you make it to the Final Four, it is the most significant accomplishment because everybody's there. All four teams are there. You're doing, you know, you're wearing your Notre Dame khaki and your polo, and then you're seeing the other guy in like the Duke polo, and then there, you know, there's like the Loyola polo and the Maryland polo. And so you're kind of, we're like, oh shit. Over the course of the year, you kind of forget that, yes, you're playing for Notre Dame, but it becomes, or whatever program, insert whatever program. I'm speaking on behalf of all players who have made it to that level. You kind of get like a tunnel vision of, I'm just a part of this program. And it's really cool to get to that level and kind of take a step back and be, oh, I remember this. I remember watching this as a kid. I remember the Final Four. I remember the pageantry, the matchups. It's kind of like what you hammer home when Anish and Kark and Quint are sitting at the ESPN desk analyzing games. So you're 100% right. And from the player perspective, it's one of the coolest, like, take a step back and realize how far you come and appreciate it before going to lose to Duke moments. As far as pass, I'll take Notre Dame. And speaking more on the bracket side, give me your top two matchups that are most interesting to you. I get dibs on Cornell, Michigan. So that's my number one. Okay, now you can get two.
Penn State, Princeton.
Okay, so I'll elaborate on Cornell, Michigan, because as we alluded to earlier, I don't know how good the Ivies are because of their performances in late May and early March. I think their performances in the out-of-conference, specifically Penn State, we already mentioned, versus the red-hot Michigan Wolverines, who just beat Maryland to a pulp and beat a very good Penn State team prior to that. Don't want to discount Penn State. Penn State's victory for the Michigan as anything other than very impressive. So I'm really curious, because this to me is not only a great personnel matchup, but it's a great matchup as far as how much value I'm putting in the Ivy League. How good is the Big Ten? Is Michigan just kind of fluking their way to incredible performances and catching teams repeatedly off guard? I don't think so. So this clears up a lot of how I'm going to remember the season. So for next year, if the Ivy Leagues are good, I'm going to say, well, hey, remember when Cornell lost to Michigan, they shouldn't even have one seed. Or I'm going to say, yeah, you know, the Ivy League, even though they lose in February, they can make some noise. They beat the Big Ten championship. So why do you choose the Princeton and Penn State game?
Everything you just said, except flipped, because the hot team is Princeton and the team that lost is Penn State. So, I mean, I don't even know if we need to go down the kind of litany of reasons why this has the potential to be an exciting game. Goalie play is going to be awesome. You got Jack Frakian at one end of the field and Mike Jean Forcaro at the other end of the field.
Sorry.
He's from Delaware. Like, I don't even know.
Yeah, from Delaware via Sicily.
Yeah.
His last name is Gian Forcaro.
So, yeah, I mean, the face-off matchup is going to be really compelling. It's not a strength, or it's, I don't want to say it's not a strength, but like, neither team is likely to dominate is probably the way that I should best say it. I assume, well, Jack Posey will guard Colter McAsee, so that'll be a compelling, you know, a good one for sure. You know, I'm trying to decide. Like, I think it has the potential to be like a relatively fast paced game, like a 7 out of 10. I think Princeton is more likely to push the pace than Penn State is, but I can see a scenario in which Penn State would, you know, you want to go fast for three reasons, or one of three reasons. A, because you think you can score in transition. B, because you think you can get matchup advantages by trapping their guys on or getting back quickly. And then C, you feel like you're going to struggle to score in 6-on-6. And, you know, I don't think Penn State's expecting to struggle to score in 6-on-6, but they did struggle in the second half against Michigan. So they could be looking for, at least from a tempo pace setting standpoint, particularly because one of the reasons that they were successful in the first half against Michigan is because pretty much everything they put on Cage went in. And as we've already discussed with Gianfranco Carlo, you're probably not going to expect that. You know, I think that I think Princeton, you know, they have shown by virtue of the versatility of their midfielders, particularly their offensive midfielders, that they can play a fast-paced game and they can score in transition. And I just wonder, you know, Penn State, when they do settle in, is going to play late in the shot clock. But I'll be interested in whether or not they try to take some of those early opportunities because because they'd be afraid essentially of the offense like slowing down, getting stymied, and struggling in settled defense. And also, it's the last game of the weekend, and some of the best upsets in the history of the tournament have happened in that 7:30 time slot on Sunday. This can't be that. If Princeton wins, it's not going to be like that big of an upset. But it's not just about the zany upsets. It's also about some of the crazy things that have happened in the game actually themselves. So it's just like we've been watching lacrosse for like 17 hours over the course of the preceding like 28. And so as a result, like you're kind of delirious. You need to, I don't know, get some blood flowing, and then you're just stuck there again for another 2.5 hours because a bunch of crazy things are happening on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the teams. It akin to the Cinderella team that launches threes and makes a 15-2 upset in March Madness. I love those teams that push transition and somehow find 4 or 5 goals that they would never, ever score otherwise, except for a D-middy. These are my favorite moments in all of college lacrosse, especially as it relates to playoff games, is the D-middy who's shooting motion. As soon as he starts winding up, you're like, oh God, dude, how are you on the team, let alone how are you carrying the ball? But with 1 minute left, down one, you see him wind up and go for glory and then like accidentally sting a corner. and those bench reactions.
He was aiming low and away and it went stick side high.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It just went right into like 1-inch by 1-inch gap.
Yeah, he has a snap pee on a butter knife, and he just like closes his eyes, says a couple Hail Marys, and then when the audio catches like tink, and everybody just goes nuts. That to me doesn't get better. So all right, that's a good 1-1. I'll let you talk about one other game that's potentially intriguing, and then I'll wrap it up before we get to superlatives.
All right. All right, how spicy should I get?
Don't be the, oh, I'm spicy for the sake of spicy. Just say it with your heart and your mind and gaslight our lovely listeners into thinking that this is a very serious take.
Delaware Duke. So,
honestly,
I mean,
the Marist disrespect is disgusting.
That's what I was going to say, especially because I was thinking about Josh Balcarcel. I apologize for mispronouncing your last name. Very excited to watch you play for the Puerto Rican national team in the Men's World Championships this summer. But he's the Marist D-Middy who, well, I don't even know if he's a D-Middy, but he did a full field clear. So if he plays offense, he
that
dropped
was
very
sick.
Deep. In
that
order
was
to
a great, great clip.
But when you were describing it, it was exactly what I was thinking of. When you were describing the D-Middy taking the shot for glory at the end of the game, what I was thinking about is how often that shooting motion ends with them on their bellies because they basically just put all of their weight into their shot. In Josh's case, he had just sprinted 140 yards and run through six defensive players. So I think fatigue had a little bit more to do with the prone position that he ended up in. But he liked the tweet that I posted about how tired he actually was. So I don't know, infer whatever from that as you would like. But no, I mean, so I do anticipate that Delaware is going to get past the Red Foxes. So there's definitely a lot of crow that will be eaten if that doesn't happen. But these two teams played last year. It was before Delaware got hot. But you talk to the Duke staff, and they came away really impressed by the individual personnel. Obviously, they got hot. Obviously, they beat Georgetown in the first round of the NCAA tournament. So we know they're not going to be afraid. And when you look at their personnel, like all over the field, they have a guy who can make a play. And we've seen Duke get taken to the limit in the first round previously. The game that I'm thinking about, which I think was in the Sunday afternoon 5 p.m. slot that this game is going to fall in, was the Charlie Toomey timeout in overtime, or I can't remember whether it was in overtime or regulation. We've already talked about it as one of the most prominent famous timeouts, but the 2013, I think it was 2013, might have been 2014. It was 2013. NCAA tournament defending team, you know, and they scored what would have been a game-winning goal that got taken off the board because of a timeout. Point being that, like, you know, Duke has not blown out teams that they were favored against in this first-round matchup at home. And I can foresee this unfolding similarly. So, yeah, I've got my eye on this one. Owen Grant, I assume, is going to guard Brennan O'Neill. That's like almost 500 pounds of humans slamming into each other. It's going to be awesome. I mean, that actually could be, you know, they could be guarding each other in multiple gold medal games in the World Championship and Olympics for the next like 12 years. So, you know, this could be, I don't want to say the first, because again, they played last year, but this could be the second or third of multiple meetings between these two guys. So yeah, I'm really excited about Duke versus Delaware if that ends up coming to fruition.
I like that.
My two-layer spicy tuna roll.
Yeah, I was going to say that was a good little appetizer and then a good little second appetizer. We took the mozzarella sticks, threw them on the ground, and ordered two spicy sushi rolls. So my second interesting game is Maryland Army. And the reason that I think is that's interesting is borderline offensive. I feel like Army is going to really toe the line on like, listen, we're supportive of the troops, but you can't celebrate that. Like, what are we doing? I feel like this is going to be the first time where someone has to talk to Army about maybe not doing so much. And then I think that Maryland has the ability.
You think it's going to be the opposing coach?
No, I think it's just going to be some slob of a Karen on her couch. And she's going to like make such a stink that somebody has to be called. It's literally going to be like Karen calling somebody to talk to Army about respecting the troops. I think we're in a state of the world where something dumb enough like that can happen, where Army gets in trouble for disrespecting the troops. That's going to be my hot take of the weekend. Some idiot slob out there in America is going to find it offensive and be like, they should be respecting the Army. Two troops. So that's my completely irrelevant take. My semi more relevant take is I feel like there are two teams that you want to beat in this tournament right now, Yale and Maryland. Yale, because I don't know how there hasn't just been a bench clearing brawl or like a sucker punch or maybe some brass knuckles hidden in the socks, because you score on me and pat my butt as you walk by scoring a goal on me, my stick becomes a weapon, and I immediately become Barry Bonds, and your stomach, or maybe even lower part, or depending on if I'm having a bad day, maybe your wrist, maybe your knee, becomes a hanging curveball. Second, you step over me, my stick immediately becomes two weapons. I snap it in half, and then I start going Legolas style and maybe throwing stuff. And so Yale's really playing this, let's see how many people we can get against us by acting like jackasses, which inherently I don't have a problem with. It's just I fell into that trap. And then the second team that people want to beat is Maryland. not because of anything that Maryland's doing, but A, because, perfect season last year, who really cares? But B, John Tillman, I think, has put a little bit of a target on Maryland's back, because as far as the unwritten rules go, I was just asking questions. He was the guy at the bar that said, hey, Nick, didn't you call your ex last weekend next to your girlfriend at the bar? I don't know if he did. I was just asking questions. Like, bro, understand what's going on. Read the room. Not only did you order mozzarella sticks, but now you're bringing this up and getting me in trouble. So I feel like through none of Maryland's players' fault, but just through some weird Tillman, I'm not going to shake the hand of the Michigan coach. And Michigan was kind of the darling of the moment between Glovegate. I feel like those are the two teams that have targets on their back. Army knows how to execute against a team that has a target on its back. Yeah. So I'm going to tell you a joke offline, that I really think will land, but is not appropriate.
If you want to hear the joke that Nick told me, just DM me. It's at Terrence Boy on Twitter.
Okay, perfect. So I think it gives a little extra fuel to Army. I think Maryland's capable of pissing down their leg, only scoring 5 against Michigan. And I think that there are a couple different... I think that's the game where everybody's really on one side versus the other.
All right, I will accept it. Let's keep it rolling. We got some superlatives to get to.
Before we get into superlatives, everybody hit pause right now and just think of your own, because mine are stupid. I don't like mine. I think I'm better than what I'm putting out on tape. But I had a long weekend. I was traveling. I was broadcasting. I had a lot going on. So not my best. I hope you are bringing some heat. How many do you have, by the way?
Well, you gave me 4, so I came up with 4 as well.
Okay, perfect. Heads or tails?
Tails.
All right, I'll go first. So I have the best couple in the school. Now, keep in mind, these are two teams, two people that were just written off, and they've made a name for themselves. They've been holding hands, and they've been on the same team. Penn State and Michigan, I feel like they have really just aligned, said, hey, let's make the Big Ten not stink out loud. Let's show everybody what we're all about. And I feel like they are the two, in the teen movies where they get the makeover and now they're the power couple. I feel like Penn State and Michigan cut their hair, took the ponytail out, took the glasses off, put on a tight-fitting dress.
Exactly.
Took the glasses off and then walked down the hallway holding hands. And everyone was like, oh, shit, like, who's that? Oh, well, it's Penn State and Maryland. And that's the best couple of the year.
So I have to reject that only because it feels more like a throuple, which with Johns Hopkins joining in. So, yeah, I think you have to change it to best throuple, which is a very 2022 word, I think.
Yeah, my Catholic guilt, thoughts. I couldn't do it. Like, all right, let's stay. A relationship is between Michigan and Penn State. We don't need any other.
a relationship is between two land-grant universities.
Two college football blue blood programs. None of this Hopkins BS. All right, what do you got?
Not between a research institution and a land grant.
It was Adam and Eve, not Adam and John.
I am going to go... Well, all right. Do you want me to go with one that I have like a clear winner, or do you want me to go with the one where we have to figure out who the winner is?
Let's go with the clear winner and then we'll go figure it out along the way.
Best dance moves, Brian Ruppel. His extreme save performance where he was doing Dance Dance Revolution against Virginia in Charlottesville. Kudos to you. We can't do a superlatives without talking about Brian Ruppel and his save of the year.
It's so tough too, because nothing is more make or break than a dance circle. Have you ever been booed off of a dance circle? It stays.
Actually,
with
no,
you.
I haven't been, which is remarkable only because I'm not a good dancer, but I am very effective wedding guest. I think effort, as in most instances in my life, is the differentiating factor. I think I do a good job of not breaking a sweat until the right moment and then just being completely soaked. And I bring a straw hat to most weddings that I'm invited to, and it's a hit. So yeah, that's my dance circle strategy. Typically throw the hat down in the middle and then dance around it.
We gotta go to a wedding at some point, because it sounds like we have similar strategies. I just assume my execution on being soaked, like at the end of song one, I literally get like accused of stuff. They're like, are you on something? And I'm like, I'm on the dance floor and I'm a little overweight. So yeah, I sweat. Leave me alone.
Well, Nick, we just named Michigan and Penn State the best couple, so clearly we are going to get invited to their wedding.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, love wins! Yay. All right, quick.
You know the Big Ten
story.
Is going to do that. It's going to be, you know, the Big Ten has their Big 10K, which I saw about 25 advertisements for over the course of the Big Ten tournament, and you know there's going to be some silly idea like that marketing goons are going to come up with, and you know all the mouth breathers from Michigan, Penn State, and Ohio, of which I am one, are going to, like, you know, throw $10,000 at some like carnival cruise where Brutus Buckeye gets married to the Hoosier or something like that.
It's going to be like the marketing department super proud and the general America's going, what is going on here?
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's like, really? You're trying to copyright the word the?
Yeah. 30-second story, circa 2010, 2011, I went to a rival high school's prom. I went to Lakewood's prom because, cool guy alert, I was dating a girl that went to a different school, which is like one of the coolest moves you can do in high school. You probably don't know about it. But bottom line, had some enemies because, there were other athletes there. And when you're in high school, sports matter more and you're like, I can't enjoy this because there's a guy that plays another sport. Bottom line, teach me how to Dougie comes on, crowd forms. I Dougie and get booed out of the crowd circle. There's not a second that goes by without me thinking about prom. It was at like the aerospace museum. So there were like a bunch of planes and it was like this hangar event thing. I can tell you every detail because it's burned into my memory, but doing the Dougie and getting booed when you thought you were killing it is like life altering embarrassment cringe. So
it is a helpful story though, because I can't imagine getting booed off of a dance circle as if there's anybody older than 17 around. So that the fact that it was a high school dance experience definitely fills in a lot of gaps.
Yeah. Yeah. If you boo someone at a wedding, you're actually a dick.
I was just imagining like Eddie Glazner and Mike Golick Jr. just booing you as you're like, what? What did I do?
No,
go give me
no,
a little
this
light.
This was prom, which, yeah. Yeah, I'm not rattled. You're rattled. All right. Next, moving on. Here's the teacher's pet, and I've already explained why. The teacher's pet award goes to John Tillman because right before class ended, he raised his hand and said, "Hey, teacher, didn't you forget about homework?" Oh, I don't know if we had any. I was just asking the question. So that's my limit of John Tillman slander. I was going to do more on that today with the superlative, but we already talked about that earlier. And good guy. So, but a little teacher's pet action this season.
Perfect segue by bringing up a good guy. My most likely to succeed is CJ Kirst. I don't know if you saw the Relaxin' with Peacock that aired.
Oh my God,
on
incredible.
Friday. Yeah. So you've got the kid who's probably the best player in college lacrosse right now, who is like so smiley that I can't imagine that every girl that looks at him doesn't immediately fall in love. And then is just so genuine and enthusiastic in this conversation. But the thing that stood out to me was just the ability to, and it's crazy because I feel similarly about Stanwix and their other lacrosse families. I'm going to get to another one here momentarily, where you just wonder, like, how is it that these parents did such a good job where they produced all these kids that had so much talent and just aren't terrible? And so for the Kirsts, who, you know, very notably, you know, their dad was a scion of the New Jersey lacrosse community and died suddenly, I believe in 2015. And, you know, so for Michelle to have then subsequently raised her five sons, you know, some of whom had, you know, more, a higher percentage of their life to be influenced by their dad, and the younger ones obviously had less, CJ being the second youngest. I mean, When Paul Carcaterra asked him, what do you think he would be proud of if he watched you play? And for CJ to say, not like, I mean, obviously he wasn't going to say something like, you know, I think he'd really be impressed by my lefty shot on the run. Like, I don't think that was ever going to be his answer. But, you know, you can imagine the way that we've taken care of his wife or whatever. There's a lot of answers. For him to say, I think he would be proud of how happy I am, it just cut so deep for me because, you know, in an era of mental health and well-being, like, there are more important things than being happy, so I don't want to go that far. But if you can find a realm of happiness within whatever your circumstances are, it's going to solve a lot of the other issues in your life. And for a 21 year old kid to be that self-realized in order to say that, I think is truly special. So most likely to succeed for a variety of reasons, but I would argue that the chief is because he's already got like an incredibly well-honed definition of success for himself, and it's his own happiness, and he clearly knows how to pull the levers necessary in order to control his own happiness. So CJ Kirst, Nick, you and I did not do a very good job with the Good Guy of the Week award, but I if we were doing it right now, yeah, I would be giving it to CJ Kirst. He did an awesome job in that interview.
An answer well beyond his years, and not only well beyond his years, but like I know people that are well older, well more, even well versed in life that still wouldn't even get close to an answer like that. So double down on everything that you just said. And I wish, I really do kind of wish that you could have saved that for the end because I have like kind of a stupid superlative to follow it up with.
Oh,
that.
I've got a couple more stupid ones, so it's fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay, perfect. So I was actually Googling superlatives, and because I forgot, I was like, you know, who's a class clown? Who's like most athletic? I was like, yeah, these are kind of stupid. But one was the worst case of senioritis. And so I have Loyola as by far they got the worst case of senioritis because guess what? They started off hot. They were like, it's my senior year. I got everything figured out. I'm going to do great this semester. It's going to go great. And then about four games in, they were like, I'm going to start drinking. I don't care. Sue me. Fire me. What are you going to do? Call the cops? And then right at the very end, they were like, oh shit, the letter of intent that I signed for my job this summer has a minimum GPA requirement. I really got to scramble and study for these finals. And so then they had a great performance at the very end of the year, but it was too little too late. Boom, you're fired. You let senioritis come back and bite you in the ass. So Loyola, far and away, had the funniest and worst case of senioritis, especially with their little push at the end. They were doing the extra credit. They were going to office hours and going, ooh, woo, professor, is there anything I can do? And the professor said, yeah, study and win. And then they were like, all right, well, no.
It's a great call. Everything that you said is perfect. But what's funnier and weirder is that you could have made the exact same argument or the same point last year. And like, it was a completely different style of senioritis, where they actually were seniors and that was like a huge part of their problem. But yeah, it's really well said. I don't have anything to add. Most fun at the reunion. Mike Palm.
Bravo. That's a good one.
Because he actually did have a reunion this year and he was awesome at it. So, in case you can't tell, my method, I had the opposite method of preparing for this superlatives. I just went to Inside LaCrosse's Instagram, just started scrolling, and that was like my way of coming up with ideas. So I saw the Brian Ruppel save and I saw Mike Paul's jersey retirement and I was like, oh yeah, I want to bring up those moments. So yeah, I've got one more, but like I said, it's to be decided. I have three candidates for the winner. So I know you've
and,
got
and my time. One, I have an answer, but I'm not 100% sold on it. And that's the sweetheart, the high school sweetheart. And for this
senior sweetheart,
the senior sweetheart, who kind of captivated America, who was the least hated team. And for me, that comes back to Merrimack, especially early on. Bias could never be me, but especially early on when they were 3-0, and I think they were ranked like 24 at one point or right on the cusp of being ranked, and everybody was super fired up, and they were calling them Merrimack, the Mac Wagon, all different kinds of stuff. For a D2 team coming out, I just thought it was a great start to the year, a little bit of a building. Hey, you know, something to take into next year. I just don't think anybody really hates Merrimack, which is shocking for a school that's in proximity to Boston. So what other sweethearts am I missing? Lindenwood, perhaps?
I mean, Lindenwood had a nice little flirtation there in the middle of the season, but I wouldn't say that they qualify at that level. I feel like Utah and Jacksonville are kind of everybody's darlings. Jacksonville more so last year, but I think it bled into this year as well. Utah picked up the baton, certainly by winning the A-Sun, and I mean, you know, cover your ears, but might be able to carry that sweetheart status into this year, or this weekend rather. Definitely going to be everybody's favorite. So, and then Michigan, I mean, obviously, you know, very late arrival, and we've already gone over them ad nauseum on this podcast, so we don't need to do it again. But yeah, I would say that Merrimack's, you know, even if you're not wrong, which you're not, it's still a very niche claim. Like, the Mack Wagon did exist, but, you know, this was like an Oklahoma schooner. It needed to make it, you know, this was not a stretch limo. It wasn't a 85-seat coach bus. Like, the Mack Wagon, the Mack Wagon's a hatchback.
Well, Jacksonville couldn't have been it because they got everybody's hopes up before losing. I mean, Utah's a pretty good, you know, I would argue that Utah's probably a second. I just think that Utah had expectations.
No, I know. Jacksonville was more so last year than this year.
Yeah. So, I think Utah had a little bit of expectations. It's a, you know, well-funded school. They have a football program. They have good facilities. It's in a cool area of the country. Tough to be the sweetheart when you have all that going for you. I just think the sweetheart was like, who captivated America? Did Utah really? Did Michigan really? Or was it little Merrimack there for a brief but albeit short flame at the beginning of the season? I was struggling to think of another team that at least had a couple winning games and were like, watch out for this team. Potentially Dartmouth, but that's an Ivy League, and Ivy Leagues are automatically disqualified from being a sweetheart.
Yeah, no, that's a good call. All right, my last superlative, best dressed. Got three options. Virginia Slam. Throwbacks.
Wrong.
Virginia Throwbacks.
Done. Okay, so okay. What are the two options?
Penn's Reds.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third option is Navy's astronaut uniform.
Done. That's all I was waiting for. Was anytime Navy does those does anything, I'm like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. Whether it's football, yeah. Whether it's lacrosse, has to be Navy's Astro NASA throwback fits.
All right, I will accept it. A couple of worst are Penn State's sleeve stripes that we already talked about. Loyola's grays, which look awesome. They kind of look like pajamas, but they look awesome. But they didn't play well in them, so excused. And then Notre Dame for not wearing green.
We did wear green. It just was on the helmet.
Didn't count.
I don't think it counted either. I was a bummer. I want to see a green. Have you seen the baseball greens that Notre Dame wears sometimes?
Yeah, we talked about it. And didn't you say that you were going to get me a green baseball jersey?
Nope. I said that was going to happen right after I get my payment of crisp Coors Light.
Your Coors Light.
Refreshments. So, all right, well, that...
All right, well, let me go hop on Drizzly, and I'll get those delivered to you.
Yeah. I'm so excited for this weekend. It's one of the best weekends. I would say it's the best weekend of college lacrosse. The only funny memory that I have to reflect on that might be interesting is having to do the 10-man ride against Detroit Mercy, and I think that was 2013. We were down like 9-3 in the fourth quarter, and literally the fourth quarter huddle was, hey, you guys want to be the greatest upset of all time? Be my guest. Go ahead. I don't even care. And we were like, we should probably not lose to Detroit Mercy in the first round. So,
funny enough, I was at a wedding. I was at a wedding tearing up the dance floor during that game and kept getting updates. And I was just like, I might have to get out of here. Like, I might have to go home and watch this second half if that one cause turnover machine continues to strip Nick Ocello in the midfield.
That never happened.
You know what
that
I'm
was...
talking about?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking
Jordan
about.
Holpe, I think it was his name.
Was that the ground ball scrum that I just got twigged after picking it up? Or was that... Just literally getting stripped.
I don't remember because, again, I didn't actually ever see the game because I was at a wedding. I was just talking. They had a kid on the team who averaged like 5 cross turnovers a game. He didn't. He averaged like 2, but I think he had 5 in your game. I'm pretty sure it was Jordan Holtby. I also, one of my favorite first round memories is, I think it was 2017 at home against Air Force. Were you involved in that game? You certainly weren't a player, but were you coaching Air Force in 2017?
No, we didn't make the playoffs. We lost in the SoCon to Richmond.
All right. The moment I'm referring to, I think that there might be two. Ryder had like the most electric fist pump. And then I'm pretty sure he did one celly where he threw his stick in the air. It was unbelievable. Whatever. He's a maniac. I don't understand the evolution of Ryder Garnsey from player to actual good coach, because he is a very good coach. It's just one of the harder things to understand.
It's not giving that much credit. He had some interesting thoughts. He actually texted me. He was like, hey, can I ask a favor? Can you give me some of, did Kinnear do the PLL like draft trade projections? Kevin Brown. Yeah. It was like, Ryder was asking me to make fun of Kevin Brown. Cause he was like, that trade doesn't make sense. What is he even thinking? And I was like, why don't you relax, Ryder? Why don't we see how it shakes out before everything else happens? Cause I asked him to fly me out to the game to broadcast it. And he said, I will if you lambast Mr. Brown. And I said, no. So
you're not going?
Still rep? No, I'm not going. I'm kind of done with traveling. I just want to sit and enjoy the mountains.
Nick, that'll do it for this edition of the Tailgate Podcast. As always, if you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and a review. Check us out next week. We'll be back for your Monday morning. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to figure out a way to break down all 8 games. Right, buddy?
Oh, if there's any two people that can do it, it's me and you. We got strong backs. We carry the team, and we do it humbly and handsomely.
That's a perfect note to add on. Love you.
Love you too. The joke that I was going to make was Maryland is